This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Two history-making events in the greater Boston area today. The first, albeit the much smaller one, is of course the debut of our show, Radio Boston, as a daily program. And the second, much bigger one, ricochets from Boston to Washington.
While we can't presume to replace Justice Stevens's wisdom or experience, I have selected a nominee who I believe embodies that same excellence, independence, integrity, and passion for the law, and who can ultimately provide that same kind of leadership on the court. Our Solicitor General and my friend, Elena Kagan.
President Barack Obama announced this morning that he's nominating Solicitor General Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. If confirmed, Kagan would be the third woman on the nation's highest court, replacing retiring Justice John Paul Stevens. Kagan's record as Solicitor General will certainly come under close scrutiny, but it's her record right here as Dean of Harvard Law School that both President Obama and Kagan herself highlighted this morning as one of her biggest qualifications for the high court.
I had the privilege of leading one of the world's great law schools and of working there to bring people together and to help ensure that they and the school were making the largest possible contribution to the public good.
So how does that Cambridge experience really factor into her potential performance on the bench? Do you think the former Harvard Law Dean and current Solicitor General is the right pick to replace the famously consensus-building Stevens? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, joining us first to talk about this today is Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, Margaret Marshall. Welcome to Radio Boston, Chief Justice Marshall.
Thank you, Ms. Chakrabarty.
It is truly wonderful to have you. Let me just start by asking you, you've observed Elena Kagan's time at Harvard, and you yourself were former general counsel of Harvard University before your appointment to the SJC there. So what do you think we can take away from Elena Kagan's time at Harvard Law School about her leadership there?
Let me say first that Elena Kagan joined the Harvard Law School faculty after I had left Harvard and was already sitting as a justice on the Supreme Judicial Court. But after she came to Cambridge and joined the faculty, I came to know her well and saw a fair amount of her. I think what one really looks for in any justice, but particularly a justice on an appellate court where you will be sitting with a group, in her case, of nine justices, in my case, of seven justices, are attributes that I think serve any dean of any great academic institution well. Tenured members of the faculty are just that. They are tenured, and they have lifetime appointments, and so you have to work within a framework which is a little different from the normal sort of business environment where people can be promoted or hired or fired without regard for tenure.
Yeah, it's much like the lifetime tenure that members of the High Court have.
That is correct. And in particular, when you are working where you have to be, as it were, a strategic coalition builder, because it's not very helpful for any justice to write a dissenting opinion all of the times. In fact, at the beginning of our country, there were no dissenting opinions. The first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Chief Justice John Marshall, felt very strongly that the justices should consider, deliberate, consult with each other, and reach a consensus, and then issue the opinion, the judgment of the court. Many dissenting and concurring opinions are something that is relatively new.
Chief Justice Marshall, if I may, so in this case, do you believe, are you basically speaking of the fact that sometimes consensus building may mean softening the opposition but not necessarily standing in opposition all the time? In other words, if you're on the other side of an opinion, getting the affirmative opinion to maybe be a little less strident than you might have liked, that kind of consensus building?
In my experience, it's partly reducing to the real nub of the case, mm-hmm. to the real focus, the single fact that might make a difference. I think the mistake that new justices make, and I'm sure I made a fair number of mistakes as a new justice, is wanting to reach a broad decision that covers multiple cases. There's a legal doctrine in our United States jurisprudence, which is that, you know, there must be a case or controversy before the court rules in a particular case. We don't give broad, sweeping advisory opinions. And I think the most successful appellate justices are those who manage to find the core place where you can, in fact, persuade a majority of your court, in my case, that's four, to join you in that piece of it and leave to another day perhaps a broader statement which may be more embracing.
Mm. So it's not just consensus building, it's really being able to drive to the heart of the matter and actually bringing people over to your side sometimes if that's what's necessary. But Chief Justice...
Okay, let me just say this.
Sure.
I prefer the term coalition building rather than consensus building, because quite often you may in fact still have some differences with your colleagues on a broader reach of the case. And what I remember attending the memorial service for Justice Brennan, at which Justice Souter spoke, and Justice Souter mentioned in his really wonderful remarks that day that one of the most important things that Justice Brennan had taught him was to count to five.
Hmm.
Of course, there are nine justices on the United States Supreme Court, and counting to five was very important. And I think that that's one of the skills that an appellate justice has, and I think that it's certainly one of the skills that you have to have when you are in any kind of administrative position within a university.
Chief Justice Marshall, so regarding Elena Kagan herself and her ability, as we've been told or are hearing, to build these coalitions, at times, at her tenure as dean of Harvard Law School, it seemed that she built those coalitions by actually standing her ground. For example, in her appointment or hiring of some controversial professors who are now at the law school. So, is that another way in which you see Elena Kagan perhaps translating her Harvard experience to the High Court if she is appointed?
I don't know, you know, about the particular appointments because I wasn't there at the time. I think that what any dean, and certainly she seems to have fallen into this category, wants to do is to attract the very best and the brightest in an academic institution, especially one like Harvard, which is such a great institution. You want to attract the very best students and you want to attract the very best faculty. That is what makes a great university. I think she saw that as her role, as any academic dean sees as her role. And I think she used whatever skills she had. And as I say, I wasn't on the faculty. I mean, I wasn't part of Harvard at the time.
That's correct.
She was able to do that. In some respects, there were many, many appointments during her tenure, quite a remarkable number of appointments. And I think that in faculty appointments, as in so many other ways, she really, used her tenure to strengthen and to build a great law school, and it certainly is that. Now, of course, I should say I'm a Yale law school graduate, but Yale still is number one.
So. The rivalry never dies, I understand.
The rivalry has not died.
Chief Justice Marshall, one final question to you, if I may, because there is some, while your time at Harvard did not overlap, she came to Harvard as dean in 2003, and you had left your position as general counsel of the university in roughly 1996.
Right.
But there is a bit of similarity between the two of you. When you were appointed to the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, you didn't have previous experience on the bench, and neither does Elena Kagan. So what would you say, is the learning curve for a new justice who hadn't, donned those robes before?
I think the learning curve is steep, as it is when one takes on any position, particularly one at the level at which any new justice on the United States Supreme Court takes on the position. On the other hand, when I was appointed as the general counsel at Harvard University, I hadn't had a great deal of practice in those areas of expertise. We've had a wonderful tradition in the United States with appointments to the United States Supreme Court of people coming from all kinds of backgrounds. Chief Justice Earl Warren, for example, had never sat as a judge.
He was governor of California beforehand, yes.
But never been a judge.
That's correct.
Their governors who've been judges, he had no judicial experience, and he became the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Was my learning curve steep? It was very steep indeed. On the other hand, the great advantage of being on an appellate court is that I had six colleagues who could gently and sometimes not so gently explain to me when I was getting it a little bit wrong. I think in some ways when you become a trial judge and you're all alone in that courtroom for the first time, that is a very, very demanding challenge.
Well, that's Chief Justice Margaret Marshall. She's Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. Chief Justice Marshall, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we'll come back in just a moment with much more on Elena Kagan, her time at Harvard Law School, and what it means for her potential participation on the Supreme Court. We'll be joined by a couple people who followed her career very closely. You can join us as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back. This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A little later in the show, we'll kick off our series of conversations with the Massachusetts gubernatorial candidates. First up is Republican Charlie Baker. You'll hear that in a moment, but right now we're talking about President Obama's nominee for Supreme Court Justice, Elena Kagan. She's former dean of the Harvard Law School, and we're also talking about what her time there at Harvard might tell us, if anything, about what kind of justice she could be. What's your take on the Kagan pick? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, with us now is Cambridge criminal defense and civil rights lawyer, Boston Phoenix columnist, and Harvard Law School alum Harvey Silverglate. Harvey Silverglate recently wrote a piece in the Boston Phoenix titled Elena Kagan's Shaky Record. Harvey Silverglate, welcome to Radio Boston, and thanks for being with us.
Good to be here at your first performance.
We're delighted to have you. Also with us in studio is staff writer for the Boston Globe's Idea section. He's Drake Bennett. He wrote a piece about Elena Kagan's time at Harvard. Drake Bennett, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Drake, let me just start off with you really quickly. Your piece was really quite in-depth about the monumental changes, not just in the number of faculty members at Harvard while Kagan was there, but just in the tone of and how she managed to change what was once a sort of a ossified and sometimes fractious staff into a more cohesive law school.
I think Harvard Law School probably is perhaps the world's most famous law school, but for a while its reputation was as a pretty underperforming place, sort of a big place, a place where the students and faculty were pretty unhappy, and a place that had trouble getting anything done, whether that's hiring new professors or changing its curriculum in any way. And Kagan really is credited with changing all of that very quickly.
And she did it in both big and little ways. I mean, some students' favorite stories from there include that she put free tampons in the women's bathroom and free coffee in the rooms where there was where classes were held, and a beach volleyball court on the outside. Those don't actually seem to be things that, you know, might work so well maybe in the Supreme Court.
Right. I mean, when I asked her about this, she said that was something she'd learned from her old boss, Bill Clinton, that these sort of small, visible quality of life changes can actually mean a lot. And it's funny, if you talk to students and former students, those things come up as much as the sort of star professor hires and things like that.
Well, and on those star professor hires, actually, many of them were quite controversial. She brought in some former lawyers from the Bush administration. Right. That caused a ruckus at Harvard. Also, a former clerk for Judge Robert Bork, who, of course, was not admitted to the Supreme Court. How did she manage to get those more controversial picks into Harvard Law School?
Right. I mean, it's interesting what you were saying with the Chief Justice earlier. I think one thing she showed a real skill for at Harvard was vote counting and counting the number of votes she had for particular hires. And the big controversy was over Jack Goldsmith, because there are a few professors at the law school who thought, erroneously it turned out, that he had written the torture memos or been involved in writing the torture memos in the Bush administration. And they were pretty dead set against hiring him. And Kagan managed sort of through gentle means and some arm twisting to basically push that hire through.
Mm-hmm. Harvey Silverglate, your article in the Boston Phoenix, I mean, we've been hearing a lot about Kagan's coalition building, her consensus building. Everyone seemed to love her at Harvard. But this doesn't really actually tell us much, or does it, about what kind of justice she would be?
Well, I'll tell you one thing it tells us. And I, by the way, think that despite the fact that in my Phoenix column I was critical of some aspects of her performance as Solicitor General, at Harvard, she had a marvelous record and a marvelous success, but I don't think that commentators are getting the real reason that she succeeded as dean. She went into an institution that was so bound in politically correct thinking that it was very hard for anybody to say something that went against the perceived wisdom. Harvard was a place where, to put it mildly, you had more freedom of speech and thought in Harvard Yard, in Harvard Square, than you did in Harvard Yard and on the law school campus. She changed all that. Elena Kagan is a great believer in free speech, free ideas, First Amendment, academic freedom, and she opened up the atmosphere on the campus. It was no longer faculty members who had dissenting ideas, no longer were sort of terrified to say what they really thought. And the same with students, by the way. Prior to her administration, students at Harvard were punished for engaging in politically incorrect parodies. And by the way, it's a terror that has returned under the new dean. So the period of Elena Kagan's deanship was really a breath of fresh air.
But Harvey, let me just cut in there for a second, because while she, as you say, she may be a defender of free speech, et cetera, her time as Solicitor General has also made her seem to be a defender of expanded executive power. That was what you'd been writing about and are a little concerned about.
Right, but I was commenting on, you know, her performance as dean, which I think was exemplary. The problem that she is, that she's exhibited in her position with the Obama administration is that she has taken positions in arguments before the court in favor of executive authority, that is to say presidential power, that are really quite extreme and that mirror positions that were taken during the Bush administration. Now, I've been criticized for what I wrote in the Phoenix because people say, well, you know, she was not arguing her personal philosophy. She was arguing what she had to because it was the position of her boss, the president. Well, this is sort of true, but not entirely true. There have been a number of instances in recent history where solicitors general, as a matter of conscience, took positions that were different than the positions of the administration or the president, where they indicated their dissent in a footnote in a brief, for example, where they refused to argue a case, taking a position that they disagreed with as a matter of conscience. So the Solicitor General isn't quite the servant and the puppet that one thinks. And she took some positions in war on terror national security cases that actually had me gasping. But, you know, I understand. One can still say, well, they were not her personal views. I actually think she does have personal views that are very favorable to executive authority. It's the one area where I am skeptical about her as a justice. Otherwise, I think she would make a superb justice. But this is a very big exception. This is a very big area of concern, and I would hope that the members of the Judiciary Committee would question her closely about these areas.
Harvey, hang in there for just a second. I want to sneak in one call. Adam's calling from Roslindale. Welcome to Radio Boston, Adam.
Hi, Meghna. It's great to be on.
Hey, what's your thought today? Go ahead, Adam.
I'm a former student under Dean Kagan, graduated in 06. And, you know, I have, as basically every other student who was at HLS under her, you know, have nothing but positive things to say. The thing in particular that stuck out in my mind is when I was deciding what law school to go to, you know, she had just been named dean, and my friend was in his class and said, hey, you know, Adam's thinking about going to Chicago. You got to send him an email and convince him to come to Harvard, because she had previously taught at Chicago. And she sent me a personal email. I was really blown away, a very long and detailed personal email. She wasn't slamming Chicago by any stretch, but just sort of laying out the case methodically why I should come to Harvard, even though Chicago was giving me a full ride. And, you know, I ended up at Harvard because, I mean, I think in part because of her persuasive style of laying it out and explaining why Harvard would be a better place for me.
Adam, thanks so much for your call. Drake Bennett, it seems like students definitely really loved Elena Kagan at Harvard Law. And not only did she apparently poach Adam from the University of Chicago, but she also famously poached Cass Sunstein, a legal scholar who came to Harvard later under Elena Kagan as well. Overall, this sense of this personal touch, did you see it in other ways that she sort of transformed the law school?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you talk to faculty and students there, you really got a sense that she was just always out there talking to people. She was inviting faculty and students over to her house. She was always sort of meeting with student organizations. I think a lot of the reason she was as popular as she was among conservative students and faculty is that she just sort of made herself very available to them and spoke to the Federalist Society. Spoke to students in smaller venues, those sorts of things.
Apparently got a standing ovation from the Federalist Society.
Right, exactly.
And Harvey Silverglate, you know, this light touch, this consensus building, I mean, all these things are very important. But as you were saying, they still don't make for a clear picture. I mean, her judicial philosophy is very murky because she's never been a judge.
Well, actually, I think it's good that she's never been a judge. We have too many prior judges on the Supreme Court now. The court is lacking in certain kinds of real-world experience that it really should have. On the other hand, Kagan's real-world experience is a little bit limited as well, but at least she has different experience than the current sitting justices on the Supreme Court. So she would add a certain amount of experiential and intellectual diversity that will do the court good.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a couple major things, and just want to hit one of them briefly in the cases that she's argued that you find particularly troubling. One of them is the Pottawatomie County versus McGee case. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that was a case in which a prosecutor years before had really framed a defendant and got him convicted in a very serious murder case. And they served 25 years before finding out that the prosecutors had coerced the key witnesses and withheld exculpatory evidence. And the question was whether or not the prosecutor or the state could be sued civilly for what the for this frame-up. And Elena Kagan got up there, and she argued that the prosecutors, even in a situation, a serious case where she had, where the prosecutors had framed innocent defendants, that they should have absolute freedom from liability. They should have a free ride. You should not be able to sue them. Now, I consider that to be a really extreme position. I attributed it partly to the fact that she's never tried a criminal case and doesn't understand really the awesome power of prosecutors to either do justice or do huge injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that it was really shameful that she took that position. Attorneys general do have a certain, solicitors general have a certain amount of leeway if they think the government has previously taken the terrible position to either change the government's position or nuance it, or else let somebody else argue the case and distance herself from it. She didn't do that. And
Harvey, let me jump in there for a second because I just got a couple seconds left. I want to toss the last question to Drake here. When you spoke with people at Harvard Law School, Drake, again, in the last few seconds we have, did you overall get the sense that the place was better after her tenure than it was before and that, you know, it was this, her skills can be translated to the bench maybe?
I think there are definitely the spirit of the place was much, students, faculty, everyone was pretty unequivocal in their praise of what she'd done to the institution. I mean, it's hard to say how it would translate into working on the bench, but I do think sort of managing the sort of unwieldy herd of cats that is the faculty of Harvard Law School, a bunch of very smart, very opinionated professional arguers with the sort of skill that she did, suggests that she does know how to kind of woo people and sort of bring people around to her side.
Well, we'll see if she makes it through the confirmation process, if she can possibly bring those skills to hurting the independent-minded eight other justices on the United States Supreme Court. Drake Bennett, staff writer for the Boston Globe's Idea section, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Harvey Silverglate, criminal defense and civil liberties lawyer, Boston Phoenix columnist, and proud alum of Harvard Law School, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.